Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here along with Chad Markwitz. We are your hosts for this weekend's edition. On this weekend show, we're going to do our best to recap really the trading in the metals and the markets that happened throughout last month, the month of May, and look ahead to some of the key drivers for, let's say, this month and the second half of the year. We're kicking off the show with Richard Postma, a.k.a. Doc. This is our end of the month, monthly call where we recap some of the monthly moves and get Doc's assessment for where he sees markets going, metals and markets going next month, as well as throughout the rest of this year. Doc, I know a lot of our listeners want us to start with the precious metals, so we will start with gold. Look, gold down again this month, 2 months in a row that gold has been down. It still is, for the most part, about flat on the year. Now it's actually a little bit down on the year, but quite frankly, gold is, I guess, hanging in there in a sense. But fact of the matter is, we've seen a lot of pressure on the stocks. Before we get into the stocks, Doc, let's talk about gold. Close the month right around that 18, let's say 40 level, a little under 1840. What's your assessment of where gold goes from here?
Well, Corey, I think that gold could kind of, for another week or two, just hang around at this point. It may move up a little bit more. If we close up around where we are this week, that's 2 weeks where we've had two closing highs. So if we get a third one, and then that starts to put it at risk. But on the weekly chart, kind of shows that gold may just move sideways here for a couple of weeks until the 26-week moving average catches up with the 16 or the 12-week moving average, and then for gold to maybe start down again. But right now, it's kind of into a little trading range of its own here. And it could last that way for a little while.
Well, Doc, we were talking a little bit before we started recording today, and you could see gold in the medium term heading down maybe into the 1700s. So my question would be, there's very strong support at 1780, and that was one of those higher lows on the longer term bull. And then there's a low underneath that, a higher low at 1721. Do you think either of those levels are within threat of being broken to the downside should this correction last longer than people think?
Yeah, I think, and I've said this before, that when we've, on a monthly chart, when we've had this long a correction, it is so unusual for it not to challenge the lower Bollinger Band. And if you look at the monthly chart, we have finally moved into a beautiful sideways trading range. And currently, the lower Bollinger Band is right around 1700. And if you look at the ADX, which is a strength indicator, the black line moved up recently, and now it's starting to move a little laterally, and it could start moving down gently again. But the red line, which is a bearish line, and the green line are last month trended toward each other, and we could have 1 month like that again where they would trend toward each other and actually end up in apposition to each other, where they're touching for the first time in months. So June could be a tough month yet for gold, even though we might start out the month where we're moving a little sideways for the first 2 weeks.
Doc, quick comment on the stocks then. We're seeing GDX, GDXJ, they sold off at the end of today, rebounded in the last hour, but they closed the week fairly weakly. And look, again, we are seeing pressure on the stocks. What's newer about this pressure on the stocks is that we're also seeing it hit some of the larger miners, because the larger miners earlier this year were still doing quite well. Now it seems like weakness is across the board in the stocks. What's your takeaway from that?
Well, you know, that doesn't surprise me because, you, as you're well aware, and if you listen to Kitco, as you're aware, everybody talks about how undervalued or how cheap they say that the junior miners are, and they are. And, you know, and the mid-tiers are starting to break down more. So, you know, eventually it's got to affect these large cap companies, and you're starting to see that. And you're totally correct about GDX and GDXJ. Not a good sign today the way they finished the day, because it looks like they're going to start to move down here again. And that seems to always predate the actual metal move. And if you look at the weekly chart on GDX and GDXJ, they are in a trend down. And it'll be interesting if they can, especially GDX, bottom at about 30 again and then hold its own. But that's going to be a multiple time if they do, where they are challenging the 200-week moving average. And I'll tell you what, if GDX takes that out and closes below it a couple of weeks, GDX is in trouble then. So that's what we're going to find out during June, whether the 200-week moving average can hold again.
Well, Doc, do you feel that some of the move down that we've seen in the miners, since it's been so much more extreme than the metals, and we normally see that outperformance both to the upside and downside in miners, but do you think they were already anticipating the move down we were going to see in the metals and that most of the damage has been inflicted? Or do you still see there being a potential for a lot of these mining stocks to even slide further, specifically the juniors? They're already pretty beat up. Could they go lower?
Some of the juniors could actually go a little bit lower yet. I think they have probably one more little downside, and we were talking off mic about that. And you take some of these and you say 10 or 20%, which seems like a lot, but they're so low now, you're talking about pennies. But that could happen once again. And if it does, that means the mid-tier most likely and the high-cap stocks are going to break down too. And then it's a matter of them breaking down to the point where then this carnage is over. And you can bet that for some of these companies, it's going to be a great buying opportunity.
Yeah, some of these stocks, they're approaching cash in the bank valuations, which I know seems cheap, but we have actually seen stocks, again, trade for under cash in the bank. I don't think we're quite in that environment yet, but hopefully we don't get there. Doc, quick question regarding a pretty major M&A transaction that was announced just today as we're recording this later in the day on Tuesday. Goldfields acquiring Yamana. I know you're a shareholder of one of those companies. This is just another example of two majors combining in the sector. It's hard to really decipher if this is good or bad for the sector, especially for the juniors, because we haven't seen any money trickle down to the juniors. So I guess that kind of makes it neutral at best. But what's your takeaway from that transaction and this general trend of majors combining with majors?
Yeah, a while back I bought some Yamana again. I had sold my position when it took off a long time ago, and I bought back just a little bit, and that kind of surprised me. And we talked about this, I would have thought maybe Yamana would have purchased Goldfields. As usual, the purchaser just got crushed today. Goldfields is down almost $3. And I actually like that, because if it keeps breaking down, then I'll buy Goldfields, although the Yamana debt situation is questionable. And I own Goldfields quite a while ago. But Goldfields is finally starting to look attractive again. But it did surprise me, because I thought maybe it would be the other way around, where Yamana would purchase Goldfield.
Well, Doc, as far as mergers and acquisitions in the mining space, many people have claimed really for over a decade, since 2010 and 2011, when it got so frothy, that there needs to be more consolidation in the space. And to Corey's point, we've only really seen it in the largest companies. The big boys have combined both in the gold and silver space, a little bit in the royalty space, but we're not really seeing those 3 to 4 dozen mid-tier producers, or maybe the other dozen mid-tier producers in silver, going out and making acquisitions, either those one-off small producers that have, you know, one mine, maybe two mines, or the large development plays that have millions of ounces of gold in the ground, or maybe 100 million ounces of silver in the ground. There are those companies that have been sitting out there on the market some of them since last cycle. Do you think we'll start seeing more M&A like that? And would that, in your mind, mark a bottom in the sector, or would that be more of an encouragement that the bull move is on?
I think that you may actually see more of what just happened with Goldfield and Yamana by these companies before they start looking at some of the smaller companies, because it might help them from an efficiency standpoint first. Then I think they could look at some of the other ones, because at least by merging like they are, they know they have a higher level of assets. And I think that's what they're desperate for. Whereas with some of the smaller ones, they're not so sure, and they would have to spend greater dollars to acquire those assets over time. So I think you could see a lot more of these type of mergers first, just because of the fact that due to the dwindling gold assets out there, that they want to do it by merger first and through acquirement. And then they'll look, I think, more at the other ones after that period of time.
One thing I'm curious to see is how these majors, as they have merged, treat these non-core assets. Because, look, these companies are sitting on millions of ounces that are non-core and are getting no value as metals prices move higher. And who knows, maybe as there are some synergies, maybe companies are looking at these ounces as the next production ounces. Again, that's just a complete guess on my point. But unfortunately, we just have not seen the money filtering down into the juniors, and the juniors keep dropping. Doc, are there any stocks that you are watching very closely as a barometer for when stuff might turn, or any stocks that you actually think are getting cheap? Because I have seen you comment on the blog that you've been doing some nibbling, but I do understand that nibbling is very small allocations.
Yeah, I still think that this year is just going to be a very lousy year for everything, for the conventional market, for the precious metals, and now I think uranium could get hit even harder, and some of the commodities. Which I think, even though they may correct to a level higher than they were, because they may be in a major bull run that could last a number of years. But one stock, you know, I really look at as barometer now is Hecla, because they're a big company, they're fairly well run, and that company to me is now flirting with moving lower on the monthly chart. It may be a gradual move lower, but that's the one that will tell me pretty much when the carnage is over. And if you look at the monthly chart, the 12 and the 26 month moving averages on the momentum indicators aren't even down to zero yet, and they're in a definite downtrend. So when Hecla bottoms, that's one company that will tell me that I better get real serious in my purchases, because that still has a way to move lower yet based on the monthly chart.
Well, thanks for sharing that outlook with us on the technicals for Hecla, Doc. I do think it's a good bellwether because it's got a nice mix of both silver and gold. It's been in business 125 years, and it's a good, solid mid-tier producer. So it should be a good bellwether, one to keep our eyes on. Let me just ask you a general question about mining stocks versus general equities, because they're all stocks, they're all equities. Do you think that we need to see a divergence between the precious metals and including the mining stocks and the general equities for them to go higher? Like, will they diverge from a crashing or at least to correcting general markets? Or do you think that the general equities will just suck the mining stocks down with them if there's any more big moves in those markets?
Afraid to say, Shad, that I think they're going to suck, especially the large cap and mid cap mining companies down with them. And we have a ways to go in the conventional market, frankly. This move higher that everybody's getting excited about, in my view, isn't going to last. We may hang around maybe a week or so, and then I think we head lower. But I think it will tend to move down. The precious metal stocks will tend to be negatively influenced by the conventional market as we go forward.
Just kind of that bear market action, right, where it hits all the markets, and it's been such an orderly start to this bear market too. Doc, before we leave the precious metals, real quick question on silver. Look, silver's holding just above, let's say, $21. but it's coming real close to having a weekly close in my eyes that is pretty devastating. The lowest weekly close that I see in almost 2 years is $21. That happened in May of this year. Again, we're at like $21.50 right now. How worrisome are we about silver leading the way lower?
I think there's a good odds that it could do that. I do not like the looks of the weekly chart or the monthly chart on silver. And I think we could move down a little bit and then just hover above the 200-week moving average. It's kind of like we talked before about another chart. And if it breaks below 200 weeks for a couple, 3 weeks, we're in deep trouble with silver. And so we've got to have it hold there. And so it's acting very suspicious right now, frankly. And it looks like this month we're going to close at the lowest close we've had in silver since about 8 months ago or 7 months. So it's a new low close. And that is not a positive thing right now for silver. Plus, the momentum in silver on the monthly chart is still above zero. And so it looks like it's going to want to move down towards zero or even sub-zero before we see the low in silver. So that means more pressure on silver, I'm afraid. I hope that's not true. But it's going to get dicey here right now. We're at a big inflection point right now for silver.
Well, then based on that, Doc, would you be more concerned about a pullback in the silver stocks over the gold stocks? And then conversely, once things bottom, would you expect the silver stocks to outperform to the upside?
That could happen, actually. And I think silver is at more risk than gold. And because I look at some of these silver stocks that I don't think have bottomed yet based on the technicals I'm seeing. So it makes sense that silver may be under more pressure than gold, and that those stocks move lower toward their double bottoms of 2020 or March of 2020. And I think that's very possible in the next 2-3 months. And I would think that would happen, by the way, because there's some really good companies that haven't reached that double bottom.
All right, Doc. So it really sounds like everything is under pressure. U.S. markets, precious metals. We've even seen base metals looking weaker. Let's talk about interest rates then, because even interest rates have pulled back a little bit. We've seen a little bounce in the bond market. We have the 10-year at about 2.84%, which is off of highs that were over 3%. Really not that long ago, just over a month ago. So a little bit more money coming into the bond market, maybe a more defensive play. Bond market moves also tie in very closely to what the Fed is doing, and the Fed is pretty much locked in 2 more 50-basis-point hikes. Where do you see interest rates and the bond market going from this level?
Well, I think we've really broken some really good support for the bond market. And I wouldn't be surprised to see a little bit of rally here pretty soon in the bond market, but I don't think it's going to hold. I think we have a lot more to move down in the bond market, frankly. I wouldn't be surprised if the bond market moves down to eventually test its 200-month moving average. And that's a little bit ways to go yet. And so I think the bond market is not done with its descent. And that, of course, fits very well into the fact that the Fed is raising rates. And I think as long as the stock market move down is orderly, and as long as the credit markets hold up fairly well, there's nothing to stop the Fed from continuing to raise rates.
Well, Doc, providing that it is more orderly as far as the corrective move in the markets and the credit markets don't get hit and they keep hiking, if interest rates were to keep rising, just normal interest rates, not just the Fed funds rate, because of bond selling off, isn't there a point where that puts the brakes on the economy, though? Because if you have interest rates rise too much, mortgage rates go up. The cost of borrowing for a car loan goes up. The cost of putting things on credit goes up. And the consumers are already getting pinched with high inflationary prices. So isn't there a point where if those rates keep ratcheting higher and higher, it puts a brake on the economy?
Absolutely. And in fact, the housing market the mean price of homes is still rising a little bit, but that really is due to the fact that those with significant amounts of money that can still afford to buy houses, whereas it's the market underneath $400,000 for homes that is starting to feel it now. And those are the homes that you're no longer seeing multiple offers or escalation clauses for. I just talked to a couple of realtors about that, and they're starting to see this thing topping for the lower end of the market, but it hasn't quite moved to the upper end of the market yet either. Now, the thing is, the only way the Fed is going to impact inflation, frankly, is they're going to have to decrease the wealth effect. And unfortunately, that means that they're going to have to impact housing, and they're going to have to impact the stock market. And we aren't even to that point yet. They're going to have to really impact how people psychologically look at these markets. So we're not even close to that yet, especially with the stock market, especially with this move higher. So like I said, as long as it appears to them to be orderly, they're going to continue to raise, because they have to impact the wealth effect. And unfortunately, that means recession, which we probably are already in, but they'll look the other way as far as that's concerned with a negative GDP.
Yeah, Doc, I think you're right. We have been saying and cautioning people, don't listen to those saying that the Fed is going to switch course next meeting or tomorrow for that matter and start injecting money into the system. This seems like the Fed is pretty stuck on hiking rates, and it's no simpler than when you pull out liquidity from the market and, quite frankly, stop with the easy money policies. Well, markets move down, and quite frankly, now it's pulling everything down. Doc, we're going to wrap it up here. I really think you have depressed enough people with this interview. I do appreciate your outlook, but boy, oh boy, this year, it's already been tough for investors, and we're not quite halfway through it. Sounds like it's going to continue to be tough for the rest of this year. Doc, I always enjoy your comments. Thank you for taking time, sharing your honest outlooks on these markets. Everybody listening on the weekend show, we're going to be right back. And everybody who listened to this on the daily editorial, please, as always, send us your comments and questions for Doc. Doc, thanks again for your time, man. Have a great rest of your week.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed those first two segments with Richard Postma. I know, a little depressing, some of his technical outlooks, but one thing you can't deny is how accurate Doc has been with a lot of his technical forecasts. And quite frankly, it all ties into this whole narrative that we seem to still be fairly early on in this market-driven bear market. We are chatting in this segment with Jesse Felder, founder and editor of the Felder Report. Jesse, let's elaborate on that concept here, this U.S. equity market, bear market. The market's pretty much every average, broad average, dropped to right around 20% down. The NASDAQ was more down than that this year. And they have rebounded over the last about week to two. Generally a bear market rally, this looks like. But what's your takeaway from what seems to be an early on, very orderly bear market right now?
Well, yeah, I think people have been looking for this capitulation. I include myself in one of them. It's really hard to get a sustainable bottom in the stock markets. I mean, even an intermediate term kind of trading bottom, unless you see the sort of washout signals, you know, high volume on S&P 500, a steep, you know, 5-day rate of change in the advanced decline line. I mean, there's tons of indicators to look at that show a level of fear. I mean, you can just look at the fear index, look at the VIX, and a lot of none of these things. I mean, I didn't see a single indicator point to a sustainable trading low in the last month or so, even though we had all that weakness in May. What we did have is some technical signs like divergences between the indexes. S&P 500 and NASDAQ made new lows. Small caps, the NYSE composite didn't. I look at things like corporate spreads didn't make new highs. The VIX didn't make a new high. So you had a lot of, and sentiment was really, really negative. So you had a lot of these things pointing to a rally, but I don't think it's a, anything that's sustainable just because we haven't seen the type of capitulation that you do normally see at longer term bottoms. Now, the problem that I have also with this idea of capitulation is that everybody is looking for it, right? And so long as everybody's looking for capitulation and this chance to get long, I mean, to me, that's a very clear contrarian signal that people are still in this buy the dip mentality. And I don't think they appreciate the just how significant the deterioration, the risk that inflation presents to equities right now is serious. And it's on two fronts. We can get into those if you want to.
Well, Jesse, I think that's a great point, because if everybody's waiting for the capitulation move so they can get long, we haven't really washed things out enough. It's when nobody wants to buy, when everybody throws their hands up in despair and walks away, that we normally see a capitulative bottom. But I'd like to back up the clock a little bit to last year when you were talking about the signals you were watching, as you just kind of outlined there in the intro. You were watching different signals last year, like the new 52-week lows, the Hindenburg omens, the amount of insiders that were selling, some of the weakness in the Russell, some of the weakness in the underlying breadth indicators. And I guess overall, have you seen those signals change enough where you would say on the reverse side, hey, we now are safe, it's all clear? It seems like those trends are still well in place.
Absolutely. And one that you didn't mention, and I think it might be the most important one of all right now, is I wrote a blog post towards the end of last year and kind of wrote an update back in March, where I suggested the stock market might be in the early days of discounting an earnings recession. And I think that's where we're at. I think when you look back to the dot-com mania, stock market started weakening, 4, 5, 6 months before it became apparent that earnings were in trouble. But there was a very clear signal that earnings and earnings recession was ahead. And that was simply the fact, Stan Druckenmiller pointed this out, simply the fact that interest rates, oil prices, and the dollar had been surging for a period of time. The year-over-year change in all of those was very, very significant to the upside. That puts a lot of pressure on corporate earnings. And that's exactly what we've seen over the last year and a half, 2 years. Rapidly rising interest rates, oil prices, and the dollar. And so all three of those things have been pointing to a pretty significant earnings recession ahead. And like I said, back then in 2000, the stock market started to roll over even before analysts started to cut earnings estimates. And so stocks started to fall, and then analysts went, oh, shoot, we're starting to see this come out in the data. They had to cut earnings estimates. And when that happened, then you got the next leg of the bear market lower. And I think that's we're in between that stage right now. Yes, we've had earnings, terrible earnings reports from Walmart, Netflix, Microsoft warned before the open this morning. And I thought the Microsoft warning was especially important because they said it is the rising dollar that's hurting their earnings this quarter. But the dollar has been going down for almost 3 weeks now. So if the dollar was going to be a pain for their earnings this quarter, they knew about it when they released their last earnings report. So something else is going on here, and it's not just the dollar. It's oil prices. It's labor costs, all of these things. You look at the other forward indicator I look at for earnings is small businesses. The difference between optimism in the quarters to come and the small businesses that are mentioning, and this is the NFIB survey, mentioning rising labor costs, and that is a very good leading indicator for profit margins. And right now that indicator is at all-time lows, testing all-time lows. And so that small businesses are telling you our profit margins are in trouble. That is a good leading indicator for S&P 500 profit margins. And then you have these macro dynamics. And so I think what investors don't appreciate today is that if earnings are going to come down, then PE ratios are still way too high right now.
That's an interesting point, because there is the argument that PE ratios have come down a little bit with this pullback in the markets. But if the earnings then drop, well, then it can get out of line again. To your point about small businesses, we even saw some of the jobs data this week that small businesses actually shed jobs, which is a bit disappointing, but just goes to show how tough it is for the small businesses to garner the talent that they need. Jesse, isn't this also all about the Fed continuing to tighten and the Fed not having investors' backs? That's been a major driver for the last decade plus, and now the Fed seems to be more focused on inflation and okay with letting the markets fall. We just don't know how far they're willing to go with the fall.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point. It's actually even worse than that. And I don't think this is something my friend Julian Brigden's been pointing out for months and months and months, that it's not about the Fed being willing to let markets fall. It's the Fed needs to make the market fall, right? What everybody looks to, the Fed included, is the financial conditions index. And financial conditions, you know, the two main components of that are stock prices and corporate spreads. And so to enact or affect a tightening of financial conditions, the Fed needs to the stock market to fall, and they need spreads to widen. And what the Fed has said, and James Bullard has been very vocal about this, saying that if financial conditions, you know, if inflation doesn't come in significantly, the Fed is going to need to push against the stock market. They're going to need to be more aggressive in terms of their hawkish policy. So they're directly targeting the stock market. I think that's the important point that many investors miss, is not only do they not have the investors' backs, not only is the Fed put expired, they need to push the stock market lower in order to try and bring inflation in. I mean, that's just the simple dynamics of how financial conditions work. And so that is, you know, part one of how inflation becomes a major problem for the equity market. Part two is that when you look back at 150 years worth of stock market data, just look at the real S&P 500 relative to its trend. There are times where we spend a long period of time above trend growth in stock prices, and periods where we spend a significant amount of time below trend. And we're further above the trend than we've ever been, right? We're 130% above the long-term trend in real S&P 500 prices. So just to go back to trend, you have a potential for a major decline. But when you look at those periods where we spent prolonged amount of time below trend, it's all periods of elevated inflation. So it's World War I, it's World War II, and it's the Great Inflation. Those are the only three times the stock market has spent a significant amount of time below its inflation-adjusted trend. And so if we're in another episode of persistent inflationary pressure, then there's a risk that stocks could not only revert back to their trend line, but actually spend a significant amount of time below trend. And so the risk to the downside for stock prices is absolutely massive. It's probably bigger than it's ever been before. And so this idea of we're looking for a capitulatory bottom when stock prices have only potentially begun, you know, in the very, very early stages of a major bear market. In fact, it's exactly what you would expect to see in the early days of a bear market. You read The Great Crash, 1929, and people were trying to buy the dip for a long period of time. And it took an incredibly painful bear market to finally break that mindset.
I think that's a very interesting observation, Jesse, because it's not just that the S&P and the Dow and the NASDAQ can return to the mean. They can actually spend some significant time below that average in a true inflationary environment. And to your point about the Fed wanting to weaken the markets, that's their way of dealing with the demand side of the equation. They've said over and over again in these press meetings, they can't do anything about the supply side. You know, the Fed has no control over the supply, but they can squash demand. I guess my question would be, we are hearing more and more rumblings, and we have been for over a year, about stagflationary environment setting up with the high energy prices you mentioned, with the high inflationary pressures. And we've just now started seeing companies on these, you know, earnings reports under pressure And the next step for companies to deal with the inflation they're also facing is to either pass the cost along to consumers, which would hurt demand, or start getting rid of employees, which would help on their balance sheets. But then we have people getting laid off, and that would be the final component needed for stagflation. So do you see that as something that would just be temporary and fleeting, or could that be a longer term issue if the labor markets start shedding workers to deal with these higher costs?
I don't think they can afford to shed workers, right? I mean, the labor market tightness is not going to go away. I mean, yeah, we probably see rising unemployment, in areas that are seeing naturally falling demand, but we're not really seeing falling demand anywhere. So this is the idea that I think, of what recession, what a stagflationary recession looks like. Everybody who, has been around for the last 20, 30 years thinks recession, and they think the Great Recession, which is the last one. I mean, it's recency bias. That's the one that's all fresh in our minds. And that's, where nominal prices decline dramatically because demand goes in the toilet and unemployment rises dramatically, and you see deflation in prices. Well, that was, a very rare type of recession. The more common recession that we see is something more mild. But when you think about even what does a stagflationary recession look like, look back to the 70s, right? In this 1974 recession, nominal GDP continued to grow at 8%. So people say, well, how's that recession rate? Well, inflation was running at 12. So real growth came down sequentially for several quarters, right? But that was only because inflation was running faster than GDP. You don't need a nominal decline in demand, in retail sales, in any of these things to get a recession. You just need it to go slower than inflation. And I think we're already there. That's what we saw in the first quarter, right? We saw negative real growth. And you talk about small business jobs. Yeah, small businesses have been shedding jobs for, I think David Rosenberg tweeted this morning, February through May. That's a clear pattern, right? But we're not seeing demand go away. And part of that is because consumers, we gave them so much money. We printed so much money. We sent it to them in checks. And they either saved a ton of money or they paid off their credit cards. So they still have, either cash in the bank that they haven't spent, or what we're seeing more in the last, several weeks or months is, the credit card spending ramp back up again. So consumers are making ends meet. They are becoming more cautious in the way that they're spending, but they're not stopping. They're not really slowing their spending. And that's just a function of rising prices. So I think what we're seeing right now already, potentially, we're already in the midst of a stagflationary recession. It just doesn't feel like it because nominal growth is still there.
All right, so Jesse, let's move on. Again, focusing a bit more on the markets and some of the sectors that actually are staying elevated, that being energy. So oil, you can argue, had kind of a midweek breakout this week when it made a run to close to 120 on the crude contract. I know that's below where it spiked in March, but if you take out that early March spike, this is just a continued uptrend for oil. We keep hearing positive comments about energy. And one thing to consider is that China was shut down. US was releasing oil from the strategic reserve, and it didn't really do anything to the oil price. What's your takeaway on how the oil market's setting up?
Well, back in, the trend in oil has been very clear. Back in the fall of last year, October, I wrote a piece just pointing out that the oil price was breaking above its long-term downtrend line. Right. That goes back to the peak back in 2008 or something like that. We broke above that downtrend line. That was a very clear signal that oil prices were breaking out of a long term range, which is about one of the most bullish things you can ever see. Then, with the onset of the war in Ukraine, We saw oil price spike, and then it consolidated, right? It consolidated, you know, from about mid-March, early March, until early May. And then around, you know, May 5, 6, the way I look at it, oil price broke out of a pennant pattern, which is just a, you know, continuation pattern, broke to the upside, that little consolidation pattern, which is another very clear signal that the trend is upward. And the fact that oil prices continue upward, even as OPEC Plus is raising quotas and the Chinese economy was completely shut down, or a large part of it, it just tells you what this how bullish the supply demand setup is right now. Even with, you know, raising supplies, like you said, releasing just massive amounts from the SPR, and with demand crimped, you know, from the Chinese shutdown, you know, we're seeing oil prices continue higher. So you couldn't have a more bullish message from the oil price itself. Now, when you look at the commitment of traders report too, you don't see nobody's long. Speculators are not long oil prices. There is no excess bullishness built into the price at all. In fact, they're underinvested. And at the same time, you have producers that aren't selling forward any product. So there's a high degree of confidence from the smart money. The oil prices are going to continue head higher, and sentiment hasn't become, you know, overly bullish. So there's probably plenty of upside ahead as we enter into the summer driving season, and we have supplies of distillates and everything that at record lows. It's a setup for much higher prices, I think.
Well, Jesse, what's your take on the rest of the commodity complex? Because energy has been a standout, not just oil, but nat gas, gasoline, diesel fuel. They've all done quite well. But we've seen a big move in the commodities over the last year or two. I mean, if you look at where things were trading 2 or 3 years ago, pre-pandemic, and where they are now, almost all the metals are significantly higher. So are all the grains. But we've seen a pullback since some of the Ukraine fears, you know, or some of the Ukraine, I guess, push in the commodities has worn off. But they are still holding their ground. What's your medium to longer term outlook on the commodity space?
Long term, I mean, you know, I just come back to a chart that I shared almost 2 years ago now, that I got from my friends at Gehring and Rosenzweig. And I called it a generational opportunity in commodities. And you just look at the commodities, you know, Bloomberg spot commodities index relative to, you know, the Dow Jones Industrial Average or any other kind of long term indicator you want. And we were at record lows on that index. In other words, commodities had never been cheaper relative to financial assets ever in history. And so we've only begun to claw back a tiny, tiny bit on that chart, right? So that price, commodities price relative to financial assets is still deeply, dramatically undervalued. And so I think we are still in the very early days of commodity super cycle. And, you know, until you have people calling for, we all know what the end of a bull market looks like, right? We just saw it in the stock market. People, you know, talking about stonks only go up and calling for all these different things to go to the moon, AMC to the moon, GameStop to the moon. When people have that same attitude towards commodities, then it'll be, you know, when people become greedy in commodities, it will finally be time to become fearful. But we're nowhere near that place right now. And so nobody thinks, you know, the oil price could go to record highs. Nobody's calling for it until we get those types of forecasts. This bull market's nowhere near over.
Jesse, what's it going to take to finally get investors into the stocks then? Because as much as broadly commodity prices are higher, some of the majors have done well, but everything else seems to have been left behind and forgotten.
Well, it's a function of two things. I think it's one, so much money's in passive these days. Just more and more money is flowing into passive. Even this year, with active managers performing really, really well, money's still just funneling out of actively managed funds and into passive.
Do you think this is a generational thing? Because we have heard of everybody seeming to be focused on passive, and that's a very good point, but we don't seem to be seeing people change that strategy even after a COVID washout and now an early on bear market.
Well, I'll tell you what will change it, right? I mean, it's going to be a major bear market, but it's also going to be, I mean, look at the outperformance of energy relative to, I mean, it's the only sector that's up this year, and it's up massively. If you own the S&P 500, you have a, you know, you had at the beginning of the year a 3% allocation to energy, right? I mean, it's that's why the S&P 500 is down, is because you have a massive underweight, and that's how the index works. It's a momentum based thing. So energy goes down, you make it a smaller and smaller allocation, and it compounds. It's a vicious cycle. Just as the opposite, you know, you put money pours into the index and it goes all into the highest weightings of the index. And so all of those, you know, get money flowing in. You know, you have the NVIDIAs, the Teslas, the Microsofts, the Apples. And so momentum feeds on itself. But there's going to come a time where investors, and I think we're very, very close to it, honestly, where investors realize, wait a second, this momentum-based strategy worked great in an environment of low interest rates and low inflation. And when the Fed could afford to have the markets back. But now if we are in a different environment in which we can't count on low interest rates forever, we can't count on inflation just continuing to disinflate for years and years on end, and the Fed being enabled to support financial assets to try and support the economy. If we're in a different environment, we have to act differently. So what worked over the last 10, 20, 40 years doesn't work anymore. And so the flip side of the, as my friend Diego Perilla would call it, the bubbles in financial assets and stocks and bonds, the flip side of that is anti-bubbles in things like volatility and real assets, namely precious metals. And so, you know, the gold price should be much higher today. It's not. Just like equity valuations should be much lower today. I mean, dramatically lower, but they're not. And this is the fact, this is just a function of people still operating under the old playbook, right? This old playbook that worked for 40 years. And it's going to take a while for people to realize, okay, this, we need to throw this playbook in the trash. It doesn't work in this new environment. And when they do finally abandon that, and it's going to be a process, you know, over a period of months and years, probably, there's going to be a shift from financial assets out of the 60-40 portfolio and into things like real estate, commodities, and precious metals. And I think that's why I'm more excited about precious metals today than I have been in, you know, probably since 2015-16.
Well, Jesse, I was actually going to ask you about when the shift to real assets would occur for people in this, as this bear market matures, because you brought up the 60-40 allocation, that classic 60% stock, 40% bonds. But as we know, it looks, all indications look like the bond bubble burst 2 years ago in August of 2020, when we got down to 40 bips on the 10-year, and that was the lowest rates had ever been. Since then, we've seen rates running higher. We've seen people liquidating out of bonds. Sure, they may get a rally, but there's going to be a point where investors look for a place to shelter the storm. And you mentioned precious metals. Do you think there could be a rotation out of bonds as the safe haven, and maybe even out of the dollar and into the precious metals? And would that create enough inflows to really get the next leg of a bull market going in the precious metals?
I do think that's exactly what we're going to see. I don't know how it exactly plays out. A lot of people are worried that, you know, if the stock market does tank, does, you know, the gold price tank also? Like it did in 2008, as just a result of margin calls and these types of things. I don't know. I don't think we're going to see a replay of the great financial crisis, that type of a crash. What I think is more likely is a rotation, just like we saw. And that's actually very similar. You know, what we've seen already is very similar to what we saw 20 years ago at the dot-com bust, where investors rotated out of the high-flying, you know, dot-com names and into old economy stocks that were kind of left for dead through the late 90s, but got incredibly cheap. And so that was a wonderful opportunity to rotate into those things. And eventually they rotated into gold and the miners, right? We had an incredible bull market from 2001-2 to, you know, 2011. I think we are on the cusp of something very, very similar, but it's going to take, you know, breaking this idea of the old playbook. And I think people are still operating under that. You look at, I mean, it's amazing to me, in the New York Times, you have, you know, the head business writer saying, I don't know whether the bear market's over, but I'm buying hand over fist and putting my money into passive funds. Same thing, Wall Street Journal and wherever you read, you know, this bragging about putting more money to work in passive funds just tells you that people are nowhere near capitulation on that front. And I think that's going to be much more important to watch for, is not just capitulation in terms of, you know, the S&P 500 index and retail investors, but when you see capitulation on the part of passive investors, that's going to be, you know, when things get really interesting, when you see the beginning of that process.
Well, I guess we'll see when investors do change that playbook. But what you're talking about here, Jesse, is a multi-generational almost change that we would see. Who knows if that's actually going to play out this bear market, or if the Fed is going to come in and save the markets again and buy the dip is going to work again. Either way, it does seem like we are early on in this bear market, but we have seen at least some rotation and some money, it looks like, freeing up going into some of, again, some more defensive assets and this general bear market rally that we've seen. Jesse, great chatting with you as always, man. We'll chat again probably in about a month's time. Really appreciate your insights. I hope that you have a great rest of your weekend. And everybody, thank you for tuning in on this weekend show, focusing on Doc and Jesse Felder's outlook. As always, you can keep in touch with us through email, fleck@kereport.com and chad@kereport.com. Jesse, everybody, have a great rest of your weekend.